Were it not for 19th century higher criticism that saw that as the shortest gospel, Mark had to be the first one written, we might have been stuck with the view of the early church fathers who saw nothing in Mark that could not be found in Matthew and Luke. And so Mark was relegated to the back shelf for 1,800 years. Not only did Mark have something to say, but he, among all the evangelists, might have been the most theological, sophisticated writer. People were attracted to John the Baptist, not because of his spectacular homiletical devices, but he preached that baptism worked faith in order that sins could be forgiven. His preaching made people feel bad about themselves, but they felt that way before they came, or at least they wanted to give that impression. What was different about John was that he said that baptism was a solution for the dilemma of sin. It actually did something. It really worked faith, almost ex opere operato. He was a Lutheran before anyone thought of being a Lutheran. Unless Mark embellished the facts, John sponsored mass baptisms. Matthew says that all Jerusalem came to be baptized, but with more precision, Mark said all the Jerusalemites showed up. Unlike Matthew and Luke, Mark refrains from calling the candidates for John's baptism hypocrites, snakes, and vipers. Baptism can even survive the crassest form of hypocrisy, people pretending to be believers but who are not. And that's pretty Lutheran, too. John knew that the husks were destined for the flames, but he left that task to Jesus, whose winnowing fork was in his hand. General confession and absolution are no less effective than the private kind. If the baptism of John was anything like the miraculous feeding of the 5,000, he baptized everyone, including toddlers who were as much sinners as their parents, but had the advantage of having a stronger faith. At least that was Jesus' opinion. Fewer biblical figures had a more absurd appearance than John. He was dressed in the skin of a dead animal who probably met its end in the desert heat. A leather belt kept the awful thing from flapping around his body. His grubby food was whatever the wilderness produced. He must have been a horrid-looking figure, unwashed, unkempt, a real piece of work. Jesus said John could have never been mistaken as a member of Herod's retinue. In contemporary terms, his hair was not coiffured, his suits were not tailored, no L.L. Bean labels on his coat, and even with a reservation, he would have been denied a table at Baker Street or Eddie Merlot's. He was the personification of God's judgment against people who live for themselves and who would soon face the judgment of that God who lived not for himself, but for others. In that day, what you own, what you wear, what you eat, what you drive, where you live, will not matter. And into that swarming mess of pathetic humanity, seeking to escape the consequences of their sins, maybe not their sins, but the consequences in the Jordan, comes the Lord of hosts, disguised as a mortal, disguised as a sinner. The one who knew no sin would by baptism be made sin, so that we who know only sin could by baptism be made sinless. Lutherans call that the great exchange. Coming face to face with the holy God, standing among sinners, John the Baptist renounces his right to perform the most menial task of adjusting the sandals of Jesus. At that moment, the silt-ridden Jordan was ground holier than Sinai, where Moses had to take off his shoes. The God before whom seraphim shield their faces stood exposed. Even without the skins of animals by which he hid the shame of our first parents. The stripping of Jesus for baptism was a prelude for the stripping of his body, for the lash of the cat of nine tails and the crucifixion, the climax of the homo factus est. But baptism was its beginning. And by his baptism, Jesus caused the waters of the Red Sea that once destroyed the armies of Pharaoh to flow into countless baptismal fonts to destroy sin, death, and Satan. Water that once flowed in Eden's four rivers sprang to life in the hands of John the Baptist and then into thousands and thousands of fonts. In baptism, the water from which the first creation was made becomes the source of a new creation. Baptism is as much a matter of the first article as it is the third article, if we dare speak in such overused cliches. As you leave the chapel, don't look down into the baptismal font, as is your custom, but look up. And you will see the heavens opening and the Spirit coming down as a dove. Words spoken to Jesus that he was the beloved Son are adjusted and spoken to you who by baptism have become God's children. Holy Communion makes you a participant in the atonement. Baptism takes us into the greater mystery of the Holy Trinity. This sermon, if it should have been preached at all, could have been preached at the back by the font. Or we could move the font to the front, because baptism is not only the beginning, but the goal of life. In baptism, birth, burial, and resurrection are all wrapped up as one. Or we could have preached the sermon right in the middle of the nave, the word that means ship. And the church sails on the water of baptism to her destiny in Christ. The Catechism says that Luther instituted baptism in Matthew 28. But there's more to it than this. It really began in Mark 1, where water flowed from John's hands that placed Jesus among the sinners and placed us in him. Baptism is the sacrament of light, the dawn of a new day. Just as the father of John had said, the day spring from on high is visiting us. The choir now sings.